start with our Father here tonight. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. For us, most great. I saw with some of you sooner than I thought I was going to, because I was here to fill in for Father Dyer on a night that he wasn't feeling so well. And so I had holy orders and anointing of the sick with you. But we switched gears now. We started that actually kind of doing that last week. And we did kind of an introduction to morality. And so I don't want to repeat any of that really. But so we start the commandments specifically here tonight. Of course, that is where the seed of morality is. And so if we started with you. We have the four different kind of pillars of the church here. So we started with the creed, and those are the basic beliefs of the Catholic Church. Then we went to the sacraments, and that is where we received the grace to be able to put those beliefs into practice. And then tonight we start the commandments, but you had an introduction to the moral life last time. And that's where we actually live out those, with the grace of God, but we live out those beliefs now. And then prayer is kind of this underlying, that'll be the last, is the last section of the catechism. But prayer is just, that conversation with God and kind of what underlies everything. And, helps to have that relationship and why we should love God and why we should want to live a moral life and why He gives us the sacraments to help us to live that. And what it is that we're believing and putting into practice here. Also, we get to heaven someday. And so, again, you had that introduction to the moral life last time, or into morality. Tonight, we officially start the commandments. We want to get through three of them. We want to get through the first three. But I also want to give you kind of an introduction to the commandments, and specifically, what it is that we're starting here tonight. As a starting point, though, too, so again, this is where I might just kind of summarize maybe or review what you did have very, very, very briefly in light of the Ten Commandments with the introduction to the moral life the previous class or session. But I remember, so in the seminary, so you have to have at least a minor in philosophy, and then they usually have like a spiritual year for you that you're trying to just kind of learn. The guy as he's studying for the priesthood learns how to have a good, solid spiritual life, a life of prayer. But then you also have to have this, again, at least a minor in philosophy. And so you have to have all those philosophical courses. And then the last 4 years are theology. And there's various types of theology. There's biblical theology. There's what we call dogmatic or systematic. That's kind of the whole, those first number of classes that we have with you. That's the belief system, again, of the church. There's sacramental theology. That's what we just completed with you prior to the last class. There's moral theology, which is what we're looking at here. There's church history. There's sacramental, or just like a practicum that we would have, where you're learning how to do the things that a priest does. There's counseling classes. So there's all kinds of different classes. But almost guaranteed every semester that we didn't have church history every semester. Oh, there's canon law too. That we had three classes, I think, of canon law out of 8 semesters, 4 years, 2 semesters each. But for 8 semesters, we had systematic theology. We had moral theology, and we had biblical theology. And so, going back to my first year of theology, first morals class, which was an introduction to morality, which was your session last week. But the professor, he's still there. So, I finished there in 93, and I started there in 89. So, and that was his second year. So, he started there in 88, and again, he's still there. And he used to be the Dean of Studies for a while, too, but he's no longer that. So he's just a professor. He was really tough the first year. The guys and everybody, so I mean, these were second year guys then, when I was a first year guy, obviously. And they called him the Beast, because that's how tough he was then. And but he softened up a little bit the second year that he was there. Not a lot, by the way, but just a little bit. But he told us, the very first class, first thing that came out of his mouth, well, I think he might have introduced himself and started with prayer. And but then the next thing that he told us was that this class was going to be dangerous to our salvation, to our spiritual health. Because the point being that the more we know, the more we are responsible before God. And actually, if we have no clue, unlike civil law, like if you don't realize that eight-sided red sign with those four white letters in it means that you've got to come to a stop, because that's what it actually says. If you don't realize that and you go through it, police officer, and there was a police officer nearby, he's not going to care. He's going to give you a ticket for running a red light, well, maybe a red light too, if it's a red light, you don't know what that means. But he'll give you a ticket for running that stop sign. It's typical God. He only holds us accountable for what we know. But the more we know, the more accountable we are. And so that was his point, this professor's point, is we were going to be learning how to live the faith. And the more that we knew, the more we were responsible. So this, I guess you could say tonight and the next, last week and the next few weeks here, that's detrimental to your salvation then too, because you're going to know more now. And you don't have an excuse, is basically what it amounts to. But some general thoughts as we get into the Ten Commandments then. One, what they do and what the moral life is all about is it's a way of living. As I just trying to kind of generalize a few minutes ago when we started here, it's a way of living. And really, there's only two ways to live. There's what is goodness and there's evil. And sometimes they get mixed together. But really, there's two avenues ahead of us here. And so we can say good and evil. We can say life and death, because one leads towards eternal life with God in heaven. The other one leads to eternal damnation, death, if you will, in hell. And or another way of looking at it, there's the road of light and there's the road of darkness. The road of light, of course, Jesus is the light of the world. He enlightens our way. Or, Satan, he's the perpetrator of darkness and evil. And and so that is the other way. And what the Ten Commandments then are meant to be are kind of signposts. So they're giving us directions. And it's like anything. I mean, you buy a new cell phone or smartphone, whatever, or a new car, you have the owner's manual. It's usually in the glove box, at least in the car. I know a few of the phones that I've owned, they always gave you kind of a thick, small but thick manual. I know the last time they told you to refer you to a website. So, there still was a manual, but it was virtual instead of that you had to look up, which, anyone knows me, that's not my forte. I'd like to hold something in my hand. I read a newspaper every day, and I'd like to hold the newspaper in my hand. I subscribe to about 6 or 7 magazines, and about 3 or 4 of them went online only, so now I only subscribe to 3 magazines. and I don't read the other ones anymore either, so I just don't like doing it that way. I'm not a Luddite, but I'm kind of close. Or some of them might say I am. The idea is though that if we do buy something new or whatever, again, we get some kind of owner's manual. We get some kind of directions of how to use this thing. And that's basically what the Ten Commandments are for us. They're God's guidelines, and they're really not guidelines either. They're not suggestions. I mean, they're commandments. He's commanding us to do this. Now we have still a free choice here, though, too, and that's something He gave us. We have free will, and so we don't have to obey Him. He is commanding us to do this because it's good for our salvation. It's the right answer here, but we don't have to. We can reject that. but then we suffer the consequences too. You know, it's the same thing. You buy a new car, and you get the owner's manual, and you read through that. And one of the things it might say is, the gas tank is called a gas tank for a purpose, a reason here. You pour gas in there. Actually, if you put diesel gas in there, it's not going to work right. If you put sugar in there, it really isn't going to work right. And in fact, you're going to mess up your car, and you're going to spend a lot of money repairing it. So, I mean, you can put sugar in the car if you want, but that's pretty foolish. And then you're going to end up paying to make the repairs on the car if you want it to run. And obviously it makes sense. Put gas in there. But it's your choice. And you can choose to put whatever you want in there. But gas is going to be the most efficient here. It's going to be most beneficial. So it's the same thing here. Is that these are 10 commandments. They're not suggestions. But they are kind of the signposts. They're the stop signs and the green and red lights. And this is the way to heaven. That's why God gave us this. That it is truly for us the way to get to heaven by trying to follow them as best we can. And, they came from Moses. Moses was up on Mount Sinai. As you may recall, a little bit of the history behind this, again, is that the Jews, first of all, there's this worldwide famine, and I did some of this with you when we talked about the Eucharist, but it was for a different purpose. The Jews were without food, like a lot of them, and almost everybody except for those that lived in Egypt. And actually, it was Joseph, the son of Jacob, one of the 12 brothers, that was kind of his favorite son, and the other sons were envious of that, so they ended up getting him to kill him. They weren't going to, and then they ended up selling him to this caravan, which took him to Egypt. And then he ended up in charge of the food supply in Egypt, which is the only country with food. So everybody had to go to Egypt to get food, including the Jews. And so eventually the whole Jewish clan moved to Egypt. And as you may recall from way back when I talked about the Eucharist, or specifically the Mass, actually, not the Eucharist, I'm talking about the Mass. But as you may recall, so they were there 430 years. And over the course of that time, unfortunately for them, things got progressively worse to the point that they were now slaves. And Pharaoh, the leader of Egypt, was working them to death because he kind of despised them. And it wasn't long, and they were pouring their hearts out to God, asking for deliverance from this. And of course, he responded with Moses and the burning bush and that whole story again. And said, you got to tell Pharaoh, let my people go. And there was all the interplay with that. And eventually, though, when the angel of death was sent to pass over the Jewish homes that were marked with the blood, which was a foreshadowing of what happens at Mass and the shedding of Christ's own blood. But the angel of death took the life of all the oldest males in every household other than the ones marked with the blood, which were the Jewish homes. And at that point, the Egyptians wanted the Jews out of Egypt. But they go into a desert. And then that all unfolds, what happens there. But the point is, this great exodus from Egypt, that God intervened and liberated the people from this slavery to the Egyptians. Well, that's what the commandments are helping us to do, is they're liberating us from the slavery to sin. Violating the commandments is sin. But what the commandments are there to do is to liberate us from that so that we know what's right and wrong, and hopefully, or the hope is, we will choose rightly. And that's the way of God, follow the Ten Commandments. Follow these directions. And do good, avoid evil. And that we, in this sense, then, know what is right, and we resist what is wrong. And that, as you may recall, they're now in the desert. God's providing for them. I mean, they're in the desert, which, again, is not a fun place to be. But they don't have water and food and everything. They run out of that rather quickly. So again, that's why they're very upset at Moses for dragging them out into this desert, even though they hated Egypt. But what will unfold is that God will provide. He's going to give them this water source from this rock. He's going to give you this manna across the desert floor each morning. And then he's going to allow quail to fall each night. So they got meat source, bread source, and water source. And he's going to get them to the promised land. But then in turn, he wants something from them too. And he calls Moses up on Mount Sinai, where he spends 40 days, and he's given those 10 commandments. They enter this covenant where they are to obey the commandments, and God will provide for them. And that's kind of where we are here now too. God's providing eventually the glory of heaven, but the expectation is we'll follow these 10 commandments. And he wrote them on two tablets, two stone tablets. That was intentional. And he wrote them on stone. So again, these weren't some wishy-washy thing here. This was the firm foundation of the moral life. And that it was, you know, two stone tablets. And again, it includes these 10 commandments, which involve, though, you know, a lot more than just specifically what they say. And all that comes later, once Christ is on the scene and gives the authority. We talked a little bit about this when I did Holy Orders with you. But gives the authority then to those first apostles, through the apostles, those first bishops, and ultimately Peter as the first pope, gives them the authority to help us understand what these 10 commandments involve. And that's what we're going to be talking about here tonight for the first three, and the rest of the other seven with you in the days ahead here. Or the weeks ahead, rather. And as we, you know, do that, there's a few other introductory thoughts here. So, again, these commandments are not meant to interfere with our liberty. In fact, it would bring us liberty. You know, another way of looking at this is if you've ever done, you know, kind of taken a drive and maybe gone into the Shenandoah Valley, what do they call that? The scenic drive there.
Skyline
Drive, thank you. Or if you over by the Potomac, you go along the Potomac River too, through the George Washington Parkway, and either place you have these lookout spots where you can pull over, and you know if it's off the George Washington, the Washington Parkway there, you know you overlook the Potomac and it's just this beautiful scenery. You know if you're out west, you're overlooking that mountain range. And again, it's just to really appreciate nature. Typically, when you pull over to one of those spots, you know, there's room to get off the highway there or whatever, the road. so there's parking spots, but there's usually, you know, kind of a short stone wall and then a railing. So it's that railing is there to say, you know, to protect you, to say, hey, you go beyond this railing and it's dangerous. You might fall and kill yourself, whether you fall down the riverbank or, you know, down the mountainside here. So, again, you know, if they put a big cement wall there to really protect you, you wouldn't be able to see the beauty. And it would defeat the purpose. But, so there isn't, you know, it's just a short stone wall with this railing attached to that. And again, if you want to jump over that railing, you can jump over it. Or jump under it, even, whatever you want to do. Crawl under it or jump over it. You can do it. So nobody's really stopping you, but it is warning you that if you do that, be careful. You're going to probably hurt yourself. So again, it's the same thing with these Ten Commandments here. They're there to warn us, to help us. But if we want to disobey and jump over it or under it, again, we can do that. So in that sense, you know, these are not meant to interfere with our liberty. We still have the liberty to violate these commandments. And to our own detriment, but nonetheless, we can violate that. In addition to that, so again, we got these 10 commandments. And you know, when you look at those 10 commandments, for the most part, what do they tell us to do? They tell us what not to do. Now, it'll be a little different with the first three that we'll be working on here tonight. But for the most part, they tell us what not to do. So there's kind of a negative connection here. We also have from Christ, when he's asked what are the most important commandments, he doesn't list any of the 10. He gives us two new commandments, in a sense, that summarize the Ten, however. And we call them the Great Commandments, and he gave us two. He said, love God with all your mind, your heart, your soul, and all your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. But that summarizes the Ten. The first three deal with God, the last seven deal with your neighbor. And it's a very positive approach here. What's the first two words, or what's the first word, rather, I'm sorry, of those two commandments? The word love. This really is all about love. Why did God give us the Ten Commandments? Because he loves us. He wants what's best for us. Here's how to obtain that. You can choose not to do that, but this is what it's really about. I love you. I want to spend eternity with you in heaven, and here's how you can bring this about with my help. You know, that's what the sacraments are all about. So, this really is, these Ten Commandments really are a law of love. That's what it is. It's about how we are set free from slavery to sin, how we can live a better life, how we can be on that right road, the road of life, the road of light, the road towards heaven, and the road that, you know, that Christ himself paves before us. And really bring something good here. Bring something, you know, leads to something eternal, eternal life with God in heaven. And realizing too, you know, when we use this word, love, you know, it's not an erotic love. It's not a kind of puppy love type of thing. I mean, this is godly love, and you know, that he really cares about us. I mean, remember, he sent his own son who died for us. And that's how much he truly does love us. And it's the idea that he wants us to be happy. Here to some extent, eternally, definitely. And so in that sense, you know, I mean, it's not just a feeling of things here, but it's really a way of living. And so commandments themselves, we sometimes call them the Decalogue, which is 10 words, and of course there are more than 10 words. You actually will see two different versions of them in the scriptures in the Bible, one in Deuteronomy and the other in Exodus. Deuteronomy you'll find in chapter 5, 6 through 21. Exodus you'll find in chapter 20, 2 through 17. And they're slightly different, very similar, but they're slightly different. And again, where they were, you know, it's all about what happened after the Exodus. But that Exodus then, it's the liberating event that happens at the center of the Old Testament. And so it's key to the whole Old Testament. Christ is key to the New Testament, but in his salvific actions here. But in the Old Testament, the key is really that Exodus and what transpired after that, including getting the Ten Commandments. In addition to that, those Ten Commandments are in an order. So again, there's ten of them, and our second graders in our school or CCD program, they have to memorize the Ten Commandments. And the preference is that they memorize them in order, because there is an order to them. And, in fact, we were just before here, I got caught by CRE father, Larry really is the DRE, which means Director of Religious Education, and then he has an assistant kind of who actually runs the program. And that's Andrea Shermer, if any of you have met her. But she's the, it was our Deacon Ochakowski, but currently it's Andrea Shermer. But she's the one that caught me right before I got here. That's, I'll blame it on her, that's why I was late. It is true. No excuse. But she was talking with, so we're working with our eighth graders who are going to be confirmed. And the actual date is April 22nd for them. So he'll be confirmed before them, excuse me. So they have to take this exam. You don't have to take an exam, by the way, but they do. And on the exam were the Ten Commandments, and the exam asked them to list them in order. But she told me when she was grading them, she said if they had the ten, she still passed them on that section. Anyways, she did demand that they have them in order, but she preferred that they would. And why would we prefer that? Because there is an order to them. So tonight we're looking at the first three. They're the first three for a purpose. And they're actually, even then, the first is there for a reason, the second is there for a reason, the third one is there for a reason, in that order. But the first three, as I mentioned a moment ago, or a few moments ago, they deal with God. The last seven deal with our neighbor. So God comes before our neighbor. And what did Jesus say? He says, the first commandment is love God with everything you got. The second commandment is love your neighbor as yourself. And so, again, God comes before us. And so that's why the three that deal with God come first. But then there's a specific order to those three. And again, those are the three we're going to look at here tonight. The first one deals with that fidelity to God himself. That there are no strange gods, or should be no strange gods before him. And God, there's one God. And our faithfulness to that one God. And then part of that faithfulness demands that we revere him. And even his name. And again, we'll get into the details of this in a moment here. And then, because he is God, we owe him service then too. And the way we can serve him is by worshiping him. And how do we do that best? As Catholics, it's the Mass. We already discussed that previously, before Christmas. And so that is the third commandment that, you know, deals with that. And again, we're going to look at all those three in more detail in a few moments here. But then, starting next week, you'll get into the last seven. And so there's the fourth commandment deals with honor your mother and father, because who, in a sense, takes God's place here? And not every mother, I mean, none of us are perfect. And unfortunately, some mothers and fathers are far from perfect. But they're not God. But they really are God's representatives here in this world. And you know, they cooperate with God to bring new life into this world. We wouldn't be here without our parents. And so that's why they're next on that list. And it says honor them. It doesn't say that you have to obey them. And honor means some sense of obedience, but it doesn't mean if they're going to tell us to do the wrong thing or something like that, which sadly some parents do. And they're the first on the list. Then it deals with how we would respect others, then too, you know, starting with just our very flesh. So that's why thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not kill. And then we would respect the spouse of that person. Thou shalt not commit adultery. And then we would respect their property. Thou shalt not steal. And then we would respect a person's reputation. The next one is basically is, thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor, or don't lie. And then 9 and 10, and they're in a proper order too, but they deal with, so here's all the things we need to do, but don't even think about doing these bad things then. Adultery, stealing, killing. And so that's why thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, and that comes first. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods, because goods are less than the spouse. And so it's don't even think about lustful things. Don't even think about stealing something. And they're the ninth and the tenth. So again, there is a specific order to these Ten Commandments. And as I, again, just tried to lay out here for you. So again, that's kind of the introduction. And so now we want to look at the first three. And of course, we'll start with the first one. And so the first commandment is, I am the Lord your God, thou shalt have no strange or false gods before me. So again, the fact that there is one God, and our what we owe God then, that we owe him that faithfulness to that one God. And on a negative side here, that we would not worship idols. On the positive side, that we worship God. And so worshiping idols would be a violation of this first commandment. Not worshiping God would be a violation of this commandment. And, you know, this isn't just on Sunday, but this is every day. And so that's why, in general here, we're getting into the details in a moment here as well, in a couple of seconds, literally. But, you know, even things like superstition and stuff like that, you know, that kind of violates God. I mean, we're taking it out of God's hands. We're, you know, depending on a, superstition is a sin against this first commandment. But you know, you think of the baseball player. You know, he's got to wear the right T-shirt underneath his jersey every game, and or you know, there's some that football fans, you know, they won't wash their, they'll wear this one jersey the entire season, thinking somehow that's going to help their team win. And they won't even wash it or something like that. And but, you know, again, is that really going to affect what's happening miles away from you at a stadium? You know, it's superstition. Or, you know, if I keep that rabbit's foot in my pocket, I'm going to be okay. Or, you know, if I'm playing soccer, I have to have the right pair of socks on or something like that. Again, that's, yeah, it might just somehow put your mind at ease, but it's probably not going to help your athletic abilities here to actually win or lose. And again, it's kind of taking it out of God's power here. And similarly, you know, that we can't just pick and choose what we want to do. You know, God gave us the way here, and we are expected to follow that. Again, we can pick and choose, but to our own detriment, if that's what we're going to do. And that's what they sometimes will refer to as a cafeteria Catholic. You know, they go down the line and pick what they want and don't take what they don't want. So, you know, what are specific things then that would be a violation of this first commandment? So the positive side again here is it's all about faith. It's living our faith. It's having that true belief in God. And so anything that rejects that or somehow goes against that are going to be the sins against this first commandment. So such as apostasy. And an apostasy, that sin, is the total rejection of the faith. Complete. So somebody that, say, is Catholic understands that and then rejects it, the whole thing and completely. And just, you know, throws it all out the window. And so a complete rejection of the entire faith. And that might mean, you know, choosing some other faith that doesn't include the fullness of it. Might be just a matter of pride. You know, I think I'm better than God. I don't have to have faith in Him. I can do this on my own. It's in that sense, it's a refusal to submit to God and to the church that He established here on earth. Really a refusal to submit to His authority. So you know, you think you're better. And so that's an apostasy. That's an apostasy. Heresy is the rejection of or denial of one or more, but not the entire Catholic faith. So the rejection of just certain elements of that. So, you know, and you're going to get more into this when we get into the sixth commandment, which will be a couple weeks from now, probably. You know, the fifth commandment too, that thou shalt not kill, that includes not committing or having an abortion. But if you reject that specific teaching of the church, that's heresy. Or on the sixth commandment, as you know, when you get into, you know, this, thou shalt not commit adultery, but included, it's all the sexual sins then under that commandment. And if you're not aware of it already, you will hear about it. Actually, I said it in the very first class that we had. But the church is teaching against contraception. And unfortunately, there's a lot of Catholics that reject that. But that's heresy on their part, then. They're actually, you know, if they use contraception, that's a sin. But their rejection of the teaching on that is also a sin, heresy. So it's rejecting, you know, one teaching of the Catholic Church. And sadly, you'll even see this in, you know, in some theologians, too, that we call them dissenting theologians. And you know, the whole point of being a theologian is to study the faith and question things, and so that hopefully we can understand things better and be able to apply them better. And but then to reject it again, that's, you know, heresy or an outright rejection of it all would be apostasy. Schism is where you don't just only reject what you leave, and you go and start your own church. Basically, that's what Martin Luther did in 1517. He was a Catholic priest. He had some valid points that needed to be addressed, but then he had some friends that, and I kind of touched on this once before with you too, that first session if you were there. But he had some friends that kind of were prodding him on, encouraging him, and he made the decision to leave the faith and start his own church, the Lutheran Church. And so that's schism. He went into schism at that point. And basically, then, that's a refusal to submit to the authority of the Catholic Church, to the Pope and the bishops that are in union with him. And another example, these, that was 1517. A more recent example, and you might not be familiar with it, and again, depending on how much reading you do, you might be familiar with it. But you have somebody like Bishop Lefebvre, who he basically did not accept Vatican II. And he was of the opinion that Pius X was the last official pope. And he died in 1910. And all the popes since then are just kind of false or fake popes. And so he started a he left the Roman Catholic Church and started his own. He would say he did not leave the Roman Catholic Church. He would say he is the real Roman Catholic Church. He's now deceased, by the way, but he started the Society of St. Peter. The Society of St. Pius X, and which was again the last pope that he thought really was pope, and so he rejected a lot of some of the things that had changed with Vatican II since about 1968. There was actually a number of priests went with him, a number of bishops went with him, and not a huge number, but there was a good number. But a number of them then wanted to come back to the Catholic Church, Roman Catholic Church, and that was negotiated with them, and it was under John Paul II, and they did come back, and that's the Society of St. Peter, the Priestess of Fraternity of St. Peter. They were allowed to kind of do what they were doing, not rejecting the authority, but they only will say Mass the old way in Latin, and they were allowed to do that, but then they came back, and they were in this kind of like their own little order. So that's schism. There's other things then too that are sins against this commandment. Atheism, for instance. So the outright rejection of God. So not the Catholic Church now, but the outright rejection of God. And the denying the very existence of God. And obviously that's pretty serious. Somewhat similar but different is agnosticism, somebody that's agnostic, which is more, they don't deny that God exists, but they're indifferent to God. Don't think about it. They think, and they have various ideas that of how God works. That maybe one religion is as good as another. They all kind of have their own kind of truth, or that basically there is no truth. That they believe that God's not really capable of revealing himself to us and the truths that we should believe in. Or they see themselves more as a deist. That's actually what Thomas Jefferson was, as an example. So he believed in God. He was not an atheist. But he also thought God was involved in creating the world, and then he left it. And he has no impact on it or influence currently, and hasn't since he created it. So that's that would be, his sin there would be agnosticism. It's kind of like, whether you've got a radio in your house or even our cell phones again too, they work on these. I'm not a scientist either, but engineer, but they work on these radio waves, and you can't see the waves, and you can say they're not there, but when you turn on your phone, they're there, or you wouldn't be getting service. So you can say there's nothing there, but the reality is that there is. So it's the same thing here with an agnostic or even an atheist. They can say there is no God, or they don't care if there is a God, but he's still there. And he's still kind of evaluating our lives, and he still loves us, and he still wants us to get to heaven, and even if we don't want to get there. Basically the agnostic is, or an atheist is even worse. An atheist probably throws the phone away. The agnostic turns it off. And pretends that there is no God there. But from somebody that believes, and obviously I do, and hopefully you do too, for a believer, we can refuse to obey, but to deny even the existence or be indifferent to the existence of God is, again, to our own detriment when it comes to our spiritual lives, our salvation itself. Other sins against this commandment are, is called, the general grouping is irreligion. And part of that then is where we're kind of just playing with the whole religious concept here. So it's not a rejection of God, but where we kind of tempt him. You know, people do this, you know, if you really are there, you're really suffering with cancer and you're really doubting whether God, you know, cares about you, even if there is a God, and you say, you know, if you're there, God, your prayer is, if you're there, heal me. And if you don't heal me, I'm going to presume you're not there. Mm-hmm. And so we're tempting God. I mean, God, for whatever reason, may not want to heal us. And I mean, certainly he wants us to have good health, but there might be some reason at this point in time that we're supposed to have a virus or cancer or whatever it is. And it might be our means of kind of suffering in this world, preparing for heaven, and then dying and getting to heaven. So again, that you shouldn't tempt God in that way. Or another sin, which is part of this whole general category of irreligion, is sacrilege, where you are not showing the proper reverence and respect to sacred things. So there's different kinds of sacrilege. There's sacrilege against the sacraments. So for instance, and we talked about this when we talked about the Eucharist, but if we've committed a mortal sin, so seriously sinned against God by violating one of the Ten Commandments, and not having gone to confession, and not reestablishing our ties with God, and then go forward to receive communion, that's a sacrilege. Because then we have mortal sin on our soul. So, you know, one of the obligations to receive communion is that you're in the state of grace, that you have not cut yourself off from God's grace, which a serious mortal sin does. And to receive communion without making our amends with God is a sacrilege. Other sacrileges, a lesser version of that, is when we things against something that is sacred. So, not, you know, if a church is kind of closed up, I mean, is sadly, I'm not, well, I shouldn't say it's never happened around here. We had out a little further south and west. There were two parishes. There was another new one. Let's see, there was one in Gordonsville. There was a church in Gordonsville, and there was one in Orange. And they closed both churches, and they were sold. A new church was opened up. It was the second church, Catholic Church in Orange, is where it is now, St. Isidore. And so, you know, a church like that, I don't know what they did. I don't know who they sold them to. A lot of times they'll sell them to some other church, you know, the Protestant group or something like that. But I know I was in Winchester, so you know, obviously here now, 5 years. I was in St. Mary's in Alexandria for 15, but prior to that I was in Winchester. And they already had built a new church when I got there. But the old church downtown, in fact, when I was still, no, right before I got there, they sold the church. To a real estate company, and the real estate company rented out the church for various reasons. I mean, if somebody wanted to rent it, they would rent it to them. Typically, they didn't. I mean, they probably had some kind of guidelines. But I remember while I was there, so this church was, you know, and there's a ceremony the church goes through, the Catholic Church goes through to kind of decommission, if you will, the church. And in fact, like, there was beautiful stained glass windows in there. They took those out. I mean, all the interior things, you know, the pews were gone, the altar was gone, all that was already taken out. But then the church sat there vacant for a number of years, and then they decided to sell it. And so they took out the stained glass windows before they sold it. But it still was a church. It was still a Catholic church. But I remember it was Halloween weekend that somebody rented it and had the satanic party there. Now, that, you know, again, the church was already decommissioned, if you will, but that was pushing the whole kind of sacrilegious thing here. I know there's a church, and I've been in it. You know, everything in moderation, obviously, but I enjoy a good beer. And there's this beer pub, or they brew their own beer I don't remember the name of it, but it's in Pittsburgh, and it's an old Catholic church, and where the nave, which you know is where the pews are, that's the seating area, where the sanctuary was, which is where you know the altar was in the tabernacle and everything. That's where the big tanks for brewing the beer are now, and actually the beer was good and the food was good, but in some ways that could have been a little sacrilegious too. Now again, it was a decommissioned church, but
Brew Works.
Okay.
Located in the former St. John the Baptist Catholic
Church. There you go.
In Pittsburgh.
With a microbrewery?
Yes, it's a microbrewery. Yeah. That's what it was. Yeah, exactly. Again, it was a good place, but I could see, it just seemed even sitting in there, and I was in there once, but just sitting in there, you know, seeing where these tanks were, and I forget what the confessionals, they changed them into something too. It just, I don't know. It was really pushing the ticket a bit. And, of course, I'm sitting there. And enjoying it on top of it, which was probably, I mean, hopefully I didn't do anything sacrilegious. But that was sacrilegious. Or, you know, if you were going to play, you know, just go down to church right now where the Blessed Sacrament is exposed on the altar and start playing soccer in there. You know, that would be a sacrilege. I don't know. I think I may have told you this story because I was telling you on the Eucharist level. Did I mention the story of my chalice to you? Does that ring a bell?
No.
Okay. So the chalice that I use at Mass is typical for, you know, I mean, it's kind of the custom that a future priest or, you know, a guy who's being ordained, oftentimes his family buys him a chalice. And that's a gift that they give to him for being ordained. And, you know, you're getting married, you put all your requests on these registers, you know, for that not to be on or, you know, whatever. And you don't do that when you're a priest. But it's typical that the family gets him a chalice. And, you know, sometimes it's a brand new chalice, sometimes it's a used chalice that they got somewhere. But my family had not done this yet. I was in my last year. I was a good number of months yet. So it was probably, I was ordained in May. This was probably, I probably got word of this year, like maybe October. And but there was a priest. Well, so what had happened in Lafayette, Indiana, there was a mother house, which is, you know, kind of the headquarters of an order of religious women, nuns. And their numbers were dwindling. And so they decided to shut down. I don't know if they dissolved themselves even, if they completely ended up, or they moved to some kind of smaller facility, but they were shutting down the convent or the mother house, their headquarters, where they were located. And so, you know, they had all the rooms for the nuns in there. They had a big chapel. They had meeting rooms of some sort, whatever, two of them. But at any rate, they were shutting the place down. And rather foolishly, and we would say sacrilegiously, and you know, hopefully it was just the maintenance worker or something that was clueless. But as they're shutting everything down, the sisters are already gone, and they're emptying out everything. You know, like I said, they took some of these, you know, even stained glass windows, like that church in Winchester where they took the stained glass windows out. They were sold, well, not actually sold, they were donated to a new church that was being built. Took all those windows. So they were kind of reusing them, you know, repurposing them. But in this case, at this mother house, somebody went through and just collected all this, I mean, chalices, ciborium, which is where, you know, we put the hosts in, the monstrance, which is sitting on the altar down in the church right now, all the sacred vessels. They just took all that stuff and out of the church and dumped it into a dumpster. They threw it away. And so somebody was aware of it and saw that this had happened and called the local parish, the local church, Catholic church there, and told the priest there, you got to go to this dumpster and rescue these vessels. And so the guy did. He went over to this thing, and sure enough, these are gold vessels. Even some of them weren't in the best of shape, but that was a sacrilege. And And he retrieved all that stuff out of the dumpster. And basically what he did is things that like a church would use, he tried to find churches that were in need and, you know, to disperse all this stuff to give them free. Because I mean, he, you know, just pulled it out of there, so there was no cost in this other than the shipping to, you know, get it to them if they didn't pick it up. But then the chalices, there was a bunch of chalices too. And so he put the word out. If there was any seminarian who was about to be ordained and did not have a chalice yet, if he'd be interested in it, he would send him a chalice. And somebody gave him my name. And so he contacted me and asked if I'd be interested in a chalice. And again, I didn't have one yet. My family hadn't done that yet. So I said yes. And so he sent me a chalice. Now, I had no choice. I didn't see a, you know, like a kind of a catalog of all the stuff. I don't even know if he put anything like that together. But he just sent me a chalice. And I'll be very honest with you. When I got it, wasn't the kind of chalice I would have gotten if I was, you know, designing one or buying one myself and choosing what I wanted. I had some ideas of what I wanted. But it was a chalice. And it's kind of simple. I mean, I don't know if you can see it from, you know, the seats of the pews, but and it's got kind of just like a, you know, a cup that comes straight up. I always, they have what they call a tulip cup, which kind of folds over on the top, like where that's kind of the chalice I thought I would get. This is not that. And, you know, it's got a note in the middle where you know which you kind of hold on to. The base is this very simple. So, you know, when I first got it, I mean, I wasn't thrilled, but I also appreciated the fact it was a free chalice. And but what I did then, it wasn't in the best of shape. So there's a place in Nebraska, in Omaha, Nebraska, that and you can take it other places too, but that place, it specializes in refurbishing chalices, and that's their expertise. So I just—it's called Cooley's, but I decided to send it there, and asked them to refurbish it. I also asked—it was a little light in weight, so I asked them to put a steel plate, a plate on the bottom to kind of add some weight to it. And actually, my family paid for the refurbishing of this chalice. So then I had inscribed on the plate that he was installing onto it. That this was donated by my family, and I had my name on it and my ordination date. And but I also explained to the guy how I got the chalice. So I said, I know nothing about this chalice. And asked him if, you know, in his expertise, if he could give me some information, some background, if he had, you know, any way of knowing. So mailed it to them. And so the priest mailed it to me at Mount St. Mary's Seminary, where I was attending at that point. And then I mailed it to Nebraska. And he called me after he got it and was able to, you know, examine it and everything. He called me and he said that the chalice was worth about $1,500, that it was sterling silver plated with gold. And he said, and, you know, again, this is 27 years ago, but he knew that it was at least 100 years old, and he knew that it was came from Germany, because he said the base of it, there was some little design work on it. He says it's German design, and he says I know that's why it was done in Germany, and he said they haven't done it for at least 100 years, that kind of design anymore. So that's why he knew it was at least 100 years old. And so when I heard that, I mean, I got this German heritage. And so I thought, you know, this is all meant to be. And it's kind of simple, and that's kind of, you know, where I am too. I remember he had the room next to me, and we were friends. But another seminarian, he had a new chalice made. Again, so if I mentioned this before, stop me. But he had a new chalice made, very different than mine. And his grandmother gave him a lot of money, and to have a set of vestments made for his first mass, and to buy his chalice. Mm-hmm. So it all came from his grandmother, but she gave him $30,000. And he spent about $5,000 on his vestments, and he spent $25,000 on his chalice.
Wow.
A little different than my $1,500.
It came out of the dumpster. Again, remember though, the whole point is the sacrilege. So that was the, you know, that idea. Of the...
Yours has a better story.
Oh, it definitely does.
For sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
This was new. I remember when he got it because it came, you know, it was delivered to the seminary too.
It was beautiful, but I mean, it was almost too much. Yeah. It was just very ornate. So he actually didn't have a tulip cup. I didn't know too. And but then he had. So on the node, he had jewels on there. He had rubies on that. And on the base, he had rubies between, but he had ivory carvings. There were like four of them, ivory carvings of the life of Christ on the base of it, too. So it was an all-gold chalice with this, these emeralds, these rubies, red rubies, and which I presume was supposed to be like the blood of Christ. But he had those around the node, and then he had them in between the ivory carvings of Christ. So again, it was a beautiful chalice, but it was so heavy. You know, I was worried about mine not being heavy enough. His was just the opposite. It was always like he had to lift weights just to, you know, lift up his chalice and his mass. So I mean, we had very different chalices. But anyways, back to sacrilege. So that's a sin against the irreligion, which is a sin against the first commandment. The third and final thing on your religion is simony. That's a sin against this first commandment as well. Simony is when we sell sacred things. So, no, like, you know, I mean, he could spend $25,000 to buy his chalice. However, if he, you know, say that was then given to the Pope, and then somehow somebody got this from the Pope, decided, you know, the Pope had this, I can sell this. And because the Pope had it, I can make even more money off of this thing. That's simony. Simony also is if we sell a sacrament and or other sacred things. This was one of his valid complaints, Luther's, was that at that time priests were selling indulgences. And an indulgence is it's an avenue for grace. But you can't sell it. But they were. And they were, priests were getting rich over it. And he was very, Luther was very upset about it. Understandably, he should have been. And the, you know, the priest doing it should have been even more upset because they were sinning. But you know, if you sell a sacrament, so you can say you can give a donation for a sacrament. But like if we told you that, so you know, people will, have masses. I mean, most of the masses, and I think I talked about this when we were on the mass. You know, most of the masses are set for a deceased person. And so they'll usually come in, somebody will come in, you know, it might have been somebody, one of their relatives that just died, or a friend of theirs, or, you know, somebody that maybe died many years ago, but it's coming up on their anniversary of death, and they want to have a mass offered. And so they'll pick that date, hoping, you know, that date's open. And here, we're usually booked up. At least 2 months, if not 3 months, even sometimes 4 months, depending on what date you want. I know, like when I was at St. Mary's, it's a much larger parish, and we had three daily masses. You know, here we have two, except for Wednesday we have three, but there we had three every day. But we were booked up at least 6 months in advance, typically, with people requesting masses. And usually you give a donation, but you don't have to. And the diocese even gives a recommended amount for the donation, $10. But you can have a mass offer for zero, you know, for nothing. Or, and there have been, there's been people who have given $50 or even $100. But the recommended amount from the diocese is a $10 donation. If we're telling you, you must give us $100 for that mass, that is simony. Or if we tell you, you know, we will, you know, if you come in and say, like, I have a mass set, and, you know, I don't have anything here, and we say, well, then, I'm sorry, we're not going to do that mass for you. Well, that would be simony again, too. Similarly, like even for like a baptism, a wedding, a funeral, if we told you, you know, it's going to be $1,000 for a wedding, and that would be wrong. That would be simony. Now, what we can do, and actually we do that here, and some of the other parishes in the nearby area here do it, we get a lot of people, not parishioners, I mean, they're from Arlington, D.C. even, but they're having a reception at one of the wineries out near here, or you know, a little further west, or Leesburg area or whatever. And they want to have their wedding here. They've never come to the St. Veronica's before, but they now decide that they want their wedding here, and because it's close to the venue. And we will, when I was at St. Mary's, St. Mary's, and I mentioned this in the course of something else, some other context, but St. Mary's used to have a reputation of being a wedding factory because there were so many weddings. So you actually had to be a parishioner, or your parents had to be parishioners, or you had to have a long history with it. So maybe you graduated from the grade school, you went all 8 or 9 years there. And then, like, I remember when I was there was a bride. She had attended St. Mary's and lived there through high school. And then she went to college in Baltimore, stayed there, got a job. Her family, in the meantime, left Alexandria. And she wanted to come back, though, to St. Mary's to have her wedding. And so we said yes, because she had this long history there. But otherwise, because the church was beautiful, it was old town, everybody wanted to have their wedding there. We just, it was just so much easier to say, no, you got to be a parishioner. And in fact, there was a time before my time there that they were doing that. They had kind of an open policy, and parishioners then couldn't get a wedding date because they were so far booked up. And so that's why we decided that there. You know, a little different here. We're having more weddings now, but of our own parishioners, but still nothing compared to St. Mary's. And so we will do this. I mean, we don't get that many requests, but we get some. And for somebody that is not from the parish, in a sense, to use the facility, not for us to do the wedding, but for to use the facility, we charge $750. We ask for $750. And that's, you know, to help pay for you know, the lighting, the renovations that we made to the church, and all this stuff over the last number of years here. We're inexpensive, actually, because now they get even more requests, and I'm sure that's part of why they do it. So we kind of discourage it. But St. John's in Leesburg, and they have a beautiful church, brand new, fairly new church too, a beautiful church. There's also an old little historic church, which they're still using. And it's not closed down or, you know, anything like that. And but if you're not from the parish, not a registered parishioner, it costs $1,500 to have your wedding at the old historic church, $2,000 to have your wedding at the new church. And so we're the cheap one. We're half the price of theirs. They're cheaper ones. And I know, I think it's, well, somebody else was just telling us, because that's why they're coming over here, because we're cheaper. but they were just looking at, St. Teresa's, Ashford. It's $1,000 there. Oh, wow. And so we were $750, so they're coming here. They're shopping around. They wanted to help us, because they're having it, again, they're having a reception at a winery. And and they were then looking for what was the cheapest venue for the church too, so
those are all cheap compared to some of these secular venues.
So. Oh, that's cheap. Yeah. So anyway,
do you have to be Catholic?
Yes, okay. You do. Yeah, because you have to have the sacrament of matrimony, or that you're going to be, yes, so you got to be Catholic. Yeah, we would not do this for somebody that's not Catholic. Correct. Yeah, it's a Catholic wedding then, or a Catholic mass with wedding. But again, synony is selling a sacrament or something that is sacred, and so that is a sin against this commandment too. And then, actually, the another one is I already mentioned. That's irreligion. Then another category here is, as I already mentioned, superstition, and that's again a sin against this here. And you know, and it's not just limited to, you know, your favorite jersey or a pair of socks or a rabbit's foot. Some kind of good luck charm, but you know, going to see a fortune teller or reading the horoscopes. Now, you know, if you just do that because it's something fun, that's fine. But if you read the horoscopes to live your life, that's wrong. Because again, you're supposed to live your life by God, not by a horoscope or the stars. And, or, you know, if you, and you gotta be careful. I mean, you know, sometimes God does talk to us through dreams and things like that, but some people, you know, really put a lot of basis on their dreams, and you got to be careful with that too. You know, it might have been just something you watched that night that caused that dream to come. Not every dream is coming is a message to you from God. I mean, it's possible that it could happen, but if you think that every dream you have is a message from God, again, that gets into the whole superstitious area here as well. Again, that's another sin. Another category is is called spiritualism. And this is, the thing's kind of connected to Satan here. Not white magic, which is just kind of fun stuff, but black magic. And so that kind of thing. Or like a seance. Or divination. And divination is where... actually, there's two types of this. This is where you have recourse to Satan. And so one is obsession, where Satan is, you know, kind of attacking you. I mean, these are both realities. But it's, if you open yourself to these things, that's what's the problem. And so, there are some of the St. John Vianney, he was attacked nightly by Satan. And he would shake his bed all night long, so he had a heart and could barely sleep, and he did barely sleep. But it was because he was so holy that, you know, Satan was attacking him. So that was obsession. But when you kind of open that door, and you're kind of playing with Satan, that's a problem. Possession is even worse, is where, you know, literally this evil spirit takes you over, And again, that can only happen if you open yourself to it somehow. And you might not purposely be opening yourself to Satan. Some people do. But you get involved in things that can lead to that, such as like a Ouija board. And a lot of people do it just because they think it's fun, but that has ramifications. So you got to be very careful that you avoid things like that, or again, some of this black magic, or dealing with some of these, even if not a Satanist, somebody that really is, following Satan, but kids do this a lot of times. I remember back home there was an abandoned warehouse, or not a warehouse, factory. It was an abandoned factory, and they went in there at one point. It's just completely abandoned, but they found all these. Signs of different kind of satanic rituals going on, and some of these animals that were things were done to them and everything, and then they were searching, who was responsible for this, and it was a bunch of teenagers, and they had found this book in the library on these satanic rituals, and so they were just kind of mingling in this stuff, but that opens the door, and it can be very dangerous, certainly to our spiritual life, but even possibly to eternity here with God. Now, they were probably inadvertently doing it. I don't, hopefully it wasn't. I mean, obviously, they were probably intentionally doing this, but did they really want to worship Satan? Probably not. They were just kind of probably fascinated with it, I'm guessing. But that's why you got to be very careful with that. And then there's idolatry, where again, literally, you're worshiping another god, and got the kind of Greek concept of that, the Roman concept of that. These Greek and Roman gods, they had a god for everything. Most people probably don't get into that stuff today anymore, but we get into other gods, or at least we make them gods: money, power, sex, something else like that. And that becomes, for some people, their God. The positive side, again, of this year is, again, where we worship God. That's what we're called to do. And, excuse me, so there's latria, that's the worship of God. And then there's what we call dulia, which is the respect that we give to the angels and the saints. And there's super dulia, which we give to Mary. So it's not worship of Mary, but it's a higher level of respect for her because of whom she is, the fact that she's the mother of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. When it comes to the saints, then, too, and some of this might have been covered previously with you, but as part of this here, you know, showing reverence to them or respect for them rather. We have relics. Like we have relics in our altar. That's typical. There's three classes of relics. First class is an actual bone chip or body part of a saint. A second class relic is something they used, whether it be their chalice if it was a priest, or their prayer book, or even a chair that they might have had, or a desk. So you know, any kind of item that was theirs. And a third class relic is just taking a piece of cloth and rubbing it on a bone of the saint, and then putting that in a, you know, little container of some sort. And actually, relics are not supposed to be sold either. You can sell the container, you can't sell the relic, because that's a sacred thing as well. And you know, and then realizing too, you know, how do we give adoration to God? And as the positive side of this, there's both an internal part of that, there's an external part of that. Internally, prayer. You know, that we try to meditate on God and connect ourselves that way. Try to have the mind of God within our own mind. And then externally, giving our life for God, being a martyr. And so that's a tremendous act of love, or adoring God, worshiping Him. Last two items here are hope and charity. And so the other is all faith, and now hope. You know, and the sin against, there's two sins against hope. One is despair, that you think God can't save me. I'm so bad that God can't forgive me, can't save me. Presumption means God has to save me. It's the flip side of that. You know, that you have, you know, we should have faith in God, but and hope that He will save us. But to think He has to save us is presumption and a sin. And then charity, we'll talk about other things here, but charity in the broad sense of that. That, again, we love, what does charity mean? It means love. We love God. So we're not indifferent to Him. We're not ungrateful to Him. We're not lukewarm about Him, or even that we hate Him, but rather that we love Him. So that's all the first commandment. Second commandment, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord in vain. So it's all the language stuff. And the whole point here is, so, you know, again, we're supposed to have this faith in God, but would we even respect His name? And again, the whole point here is because there's something about the name. Like, if you know, if you're familiar, that's a sales point, you know, a really good salesperson, when you walk into an appliance store or car dealership or whatever it might be, they always try to get your name. And because then they got kind of a hold on you. If they know your name, you know, and they'll use it. And so they kind of get you that way. And so there's a power in the name. And so certainly here on the spiritual end of this as well, a power in the name of God Himself. And it's interesting as we read Scripture, when somebody gets involved with God, not every time, but at times, He changes their name to show the transformation here. So from Abram to Abraham, from Simon to Peter, from Saul to Paul. So when they've had this transformation, God gives them a new name. And that's why it was an old tradition. It's in some orders it still is. Some it's not anymore. But it's not a diocesan priest. That's what Father Dyer and I are. We're diocesan priests. Diocesan priests never changed their name. But a religious order priest, such as a Jesuit, Oblate, Dominican, Franciscan, or religious women, they would often change their names when they entered religious life. And that was why they did it. Actually, as you get confirmed, you have to take on a new name. It shows the transformation. And you have to pick the saint's name. We told you that way back. And so you're getting very close, actually. So hopefully you've been thinking about that. And but that, again, is in part why. And so there again, is this power, though, in the name of, you know, especially God. And so that's why the Jews, you know, they would never write or say the name Yahweh. So that was God's like official name. They would never use that because they felt that was irreverent. They were not showing Him proper reverence, that they were unworthy of even saying His name. And You know, we don't probably feel quite the same way that they do. And we do refer to God, we refer to Him as Lord, we refer to Jesus, we call Jesus Jesus, Jesus Christ. And so, you know, the Lord Jesus was given to him at his birth, through the angel Gabriel, told Joseph and Mary that they were to name him Jesus, which means Savior. And then when he was baptized, and it was mentioned that he was the anointed one, that's when he took on the name Christ, which means anointed one. But then we would show above all respect to God's name, but also to the saints' names. And that's why, I don't know if you remember a while, it got a lot of publicity, this kind of stuff, but there was both these things. There was one, and there's, excuse the lack of, or the crudity of the little language here, but there was an art exhibit, and it was called Piss Christ. And it was a crucifix that literally was, and this was supposed to be art, but it was, this crucifix was stuck in a pail of urine. And that was art. There was another very similar type of thing. It was actually a picture of Mary in dung. That was at the Brooklyn Museum of Art as a piece of art. That's, again, a violation of this second commandment. Even like when we make the sign of the cross, and I'll admit I'm sometimes guilty of it. You know, we should make it as an actual, thoughtful enterprise here that we really think of it, because. But I'll admit, sometimes when I'm praying, I just kind of whip through it, and without a lot of thought. And when we make it, we're calling upon the name of the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and so we should make it with some sense of reverence and thought. And just to kind of take that casually, really is at least not a huge, but a minor violation of this second commandment. Now, what is a major violation of it is blasphemy, when we literally use God's name, abuse God's name, and oftentimes cursing is a serious sin too, when we're literally calling down evil on another person. And in one way or another, condemning them to hell. And so, like GDU, when we say something like that, that is cursing. Profanity is also a sin against this, but it is oftentimes just a venial sin, not a serious sin, because it's just a careless use of God's name. We're not thinking we don't mean anything bad, but we certainly don't mean anything good. It's not a prayer. And, again, people are guilty of this. A lot of people are. Oh, my God, when somebody says that. Or, I mentioned this that first class to you, too. It's just interesting how, we'll use God's name in vain. When somebody gets upset and they say Jesus Christ or something like that, they're not calling on him in prayer. They're using it in this kind of casual, profane way, which is why it's profanity. And, it used to be years ago that probably guys were more guilty of this. Today it's like everybody, women and guys. So I guess that's all part of the equal rights. Women abuse his name too. But it's interesting. It was mostly guys that used to do that. Women had too much class. Not anymore. I remember thankfully, I haven't really run into that here. But my last parish, I remember one. And she was a deputy secretary of education, and very had a and she was a good woman, but she obviously felt very comfortable about me because she came to see me a few times in my office. And I was shocked at the language she was using as she's talking to me, and just kind of rolling off her tongue, and this kind of surprising them. And but I remember I was on this committee at. Bishop Ireton High School, which is one of the Catholic high schools in our diocese in Alexandria. And there was this whole, I was on this committee, so there was probably about 20 of us around a table. And I was the only priest, but there was a nun there too. And, then all these Catholic people. And there was one woman, and as we're talking and discussing things, and the stuff that was rolling off her tongue, And she had to be a parishioner of St. Mary's, too. And then,
the other one swam up a storm at this meeting, using all this profanity. And one of my parishioners, great. But that's the kind of stuff, though. It's just this casual, unfortunate use of God's name. And I, when I say this used to be more of a kind of a guy thing, because years ago, in some parishes still have this. I don't know any parishes in our diocese that do. I know back home some do yet. But they had a holy name society. And it was a men's club. And it was because men had this issue that it was, they would do prayerful things and service things. It was a little bit like Knights of Columbus would be now. But it was the Holy Name Society. And the whole premise was to really work on respecting God's name and not using it in a profane way. So the other two things with this is, one involves oaths. And again, we can take an oath in a court of law, and actually to violate that is perjury. And it's a legal issue, but it's also a spiritual one. That you're invoking the name of God to attest to the fact that you're going to speak the truth. And then if you violate that, again, it is illegal, but it's also a sin. And so you're calling upon the honesty and integrity of God and saying that I respect that and fulfill that here. Somewhat similar to that, but if you take a vow, and particularly a religious vow, so such as when one becomes a priest or a nun, again, we take a deliberate promise to fulfill something before God. And so to violate that is a serious sin then for us. And so typically, not a diocesan priest, we take a, it's actually a promise, we call it, not a vow, of celibacy, of obedience to our bishop, and that we will offer these prayers every day. But a religious, such as again the Franciscans, Dominicans, men or women, they typically take vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. And then obedience to their authority, that they will be chaste as we are called to be too. And then they will live in poverty. They will not own anything. And some take an additional vow of stability, which means they'll stay in the same place for the rest of their lives. So that's the second commandment. And then moving on very quickly here, since it's almost 9 o'clock, the third commandment. And so now, again, now we're, this is the idea of that service to God. How do we be of service? How do we worship Him? We have a day for that. And so it's remember to keep holy the Sabbath. And the third commandment, which means, or remember to keep holy the Lord's Day. And again, remembering, I don't know if this has come up yet in any of the sessions with you, but for the Sabbath for the Jews was Saturday. Because they started with the whole, creation started on Sunday, the first day of the week, and he rested on the sixth day. He completed the creation on the sixth day, he rested on the seventh day, which then was a Saturday. So that's why for the Jews, their Sabbath is a Saturday. For us Christians, our Sabbath is a Sunday. Why? Because it's the day that Jesus rose from the dead. So it's all about Jesus. He rose from the dead on Sunday. That's our Sabbath day. So that's the day that we are to particularly keep holy. And for us as Catholics, what that means is we're supposed to go to Mass. And right now, there's a dispensation from the bishop that if one's concerned about the whole COVID and other related virus-connected issues, one is dispensed from going to Mass. But normally, that would be an expectation. Every Sunday and Holy Day. And we have technically 6 Holy Days. Right now, it's really only 5 for us in our diocese here. And those 5 Holy Days are January 1st, Mary the Mother of God. It is Assumption on August 15th. It is November 1st, All Saints Day. It is December 8th, Immaculate Conception. And it's Christmas Day, the 25th of December. Also, in between there, is Ascension Thursday, so 40 days after Jesus rose from the dead. But
almost the entire country no longer has that as a holy day of obligation, that 40th day, which is a Thursday, Central Thursday, 40 days after the Easter. And the exception to that, so we don't have it, we were one of the last places to switch, not keeping that as a holy day. But most of the country, so basically the whole East Coast kept it as a holy day, and everything just west of the immediate East Coast moved it already. But then Arlington and Washington were one of the last two places. The Baltimore province, which is Baltimore, Wilmington, Delaware, West Virginia, and the two dioceses in Virginia, and Washington were the last one to switch to not have Ascension Thursday. But everything north of Baltimore along the East Coast still does. So if you're up in New York on that Ascension Thursday, the 40th day after Easter, that's a holy day of obligation. And if you go to Mass that day, you're going to get that Mass. And then if you come back to Virginia, if you live in Virginia, and you come to Mass on Sunday, you're going to hear the same greetings again. Actually, because that's what we moved it to, is the seventh Sunday of Easter. So nobody asked me, because I would have said, don't do it. But as I said, nobody asked me.
I wish that... I'm in favor of having it on Thursday, like traditional, but at least let's pick one or the other and do it nationwide.
It's confusing.
Yeah.
And all the way up. So it's, Philadelphia, New York, Boston, Hartford, I mean, that whole stream there, from Maine. So basically just north of Maryland, all the way up to, through Maine, the East Coast all has, they still have it since Thursday. But everything west of that and south doesn't. So. But those are the six or five holy days that we're supposed to keep holy in addition to Sunday. And what that means, and how it's determined too, so we can go to Mass now to fulfill our Sunday obligation. We can go to Mass on Sunday proper. We can also go to Mass Saturday evening. And actually that follows the Jewish tradition, which had the Lord's Day from sundown Friday through sundown Saturday. That was the Jewish tradition. And so, for most of the church's history, it was Sunday proper. It was from midnight Saturday morning, or Sunday morning rather, till midnight Sunday night was the Sabbath day. But I don't remember what year this was. It was before Vatican II, actually. They started switching that, but it got popular after Vatican II. They switched it to, you could have a Saturday vigil. But what they did is they said, what typically is the earliest time the sun goes down? It's about 4 o'clock. So Mass after 4 on Saturday counts for Sunday. So if you go, and we get this all the time, somebody has a 2 o'clock wedding, does this count for Sunday? No, it's not after 4 o'clock. However, if you had a wedding at 5 o'clock, that would count for Sunday. But it has to be after 4. So the earliest, rather than letting that be flexible and adjustable, in a sense, depending on when the sun goes down, they just set it as a standard, 4 o'clock on Saturday through midnight on Sunday, and is the Lord's Day. And so we're supposed to go to Mass sometime there. But we're also supposed to keep that as a day of prayer and a day of rest, day of family, recreation in that sense. It's meant to attend Mass, pray, and rest. Those are the three kind of concepts for that day. Now, does that mean somebody can't have a job? No, not necessarily. Certainly like a priest, I have to work. A nurse or a police officer would have to do that. But even like a restaurant. And again, because it provides a service, at least under normal circumstances, to other people so they can rest, but realize that somebody else has got to work. So if that's the only time they can work, or that's the only job that they can get, I mean, if one has a choice, kids are always violating this, or oftentimes are, They should really do their homework on Saturday and not do it on Sunday. But, you know, that seems to just kind of float over them. So again, it really should be a day of prayer, of rest, and of focus on God, Mass. And, you know, and again, when there's that other, you know, you're snowed in or you're sick or something, you are excused from attending Mass. And if God in His wisdom gave us that, this idea, we need some downtime. And so really, it's meant as a gift. And it also makes one, this is the last thing here, it also makes a point that time is God's. And that we want to respect even that. And so that's why, again, all of these first three commandments they're centered on God Himself. So, any questions on commandments in general? The first, second, and third commandments.
With the Holy Day of Obligation, does that start the night before as well?
Yes.
Okay, so like Christmas Eve counts for Christmas.
Yep. As long as it's after 4 o'clock. Okay. Now, actually, it raises a point. So during COVID times here, and a lot of bishops did this, including our bishop, they extended the time because they said you might have to have a bunch of masses and timing might not work for you. So he made a one-time exception, Christmas Eve only, this year, that we could actually have a mass as early as 2 o'clock, and it would count. And the bishop has that authority to make an exception. He couldn't make that as a standard procedure, but he could for this year, and he did, or last year. We made a choice that we would not. And some of the parishes, some of the local parishes around here did have a mass at as early as 2 o'clock, but we thought we're not going to work with that confusion. So decided we would not do that. But otherwise it would normally come, as you said, after 4, through the Holy Days. Any other questions?
All right. Well, as
so,
always,
sorry.
Oh,
no, it's I'd hate to put you on the spot. I had hoped to ask you this before we started class, but are we still doing the scrutinies this year?
We probably shouldn't. The next week is this coming Sunday.
That's why I'm asking. Yeah. I noticed that looking at my calendar.
Yes. We should.
Okay.
We didn't really do that. We haven't talked about it at all.
No, we haven't. No.
And which masses? And I know at the beginning of the year we briefly talked about it. I think it's even on the schedule. Is it?
Well, that we're having the scrutinies is on the schedule.
Yes.
But we hadn't picked the times or anything like that.
Yeah. I know you and I talked about it briefly though too. So
we probably did. Yeah.
And
I know in past years we've done 9, 10, 45, 9 for the three.
And we could do that again this year too. I mean, unless. Let me ask you this. How many of you could be at 9 o'clock Mass this coming Sunday?
9 a.m.?
9 a.m., yeah.
At least 3 of you? 4 of you?
Okay. Why don't we plan on that then?
Okay.
So 9 o'clock, and we reserve pews.
Yeah.
We've done both, I think. Have we reserved you?
We have some years, but we don't always.
And it might be. Yeah. I mean, just because now it's a little more tight, too. I don't know what do you think?
I mean, I tend towards just let people sit where they want.
Right.
And
we'll do that. You'll sit wherever you want, but after the homily, let's say this week I have 9 o'clock, so I'll have you. So after the homily, I will call you up, and you'll just stand at the front. And then there's just a special prayer basically over you. And then each week it's a little different. The whole point of this, they're called scrutinies, it's an opportunity for the parish to see you, you know, who are these new converts to the faith here, and to pray for you. So that's part of it. It's an idea to be introduced to you, that's the first thing. One, to pray for you, but two, and they do this with weddings too. You know, is there anyone who doesn't think they should be married? it's an opportunity. Chances are, well, you might know some parishioners, I don't know, but it's an opportunity for them. If there's some reason they think that you shouldn't become Catholic,
that there's some secret thing going on here, you know, because you really want to just infiltrate.
You're all secret Satanists, I know.
Or Russian spies or something like that. You know?
Well, if we're already Catholic, though, we don't
technically, you should not do that. Yes, correct. Yeah. Okay. So it should be the ones that are not Catholic. But if anybody comes up, you can come up. Send through this.
I want to go out.
You can go. Yeah, you can go.
All right, so
we'll find his help.
All right, so we'll do it at 9.
Yes,
this coming Saturday or Sunday.
Okay.
This coming Sunday, and I'll send out an email to the class to confirm that.
Okay, and then next week, or you can decide.
So like I said, so I know you like to
give us something.
At least do two masses, right? So not have them all be 9 a.m. So what we've done in past years is
we've done the
first scrutiny and the third scrutiny at 9, and then that one in the middle at 10:45. So if you're okay with doing that, it would be 9 this Sunday, this coming Sunday, 10:45 the Sunday after, and then 9 again the Sunday after that.
And the thing that way, too, and part of the 9 was you were usually at, though, too.
Yes.
And you know, glad to accommodate that. But the other thing is, if rather than just all 9s, then other people see you too, and have an opportunity to know who they're praying for.
So if that works for everybody, we can plan on that.
Good. Okay. All right. Anything else?
No, that's all I have. And thank you for responding so gracefully to me, putting you on the spot.
No, this is good. All right. Anybody else? Anything? Yes.
So you're saying that when we go out, you're going to say that this is for the new people that are becoming Catholic. What about if you kind of like reward it and say, well, like people that are also completing their sacraments, like, I'm going to be
thinking. I will do that. Happy to.
In past years, we've usually welcomed everyone who's in the class, right? Regardless of their sacramental status.
Yeah.
So.
You're welcome. All right, we'll close this with give you a blessing. May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Have a good night. Good to see everybody again.
Thank you, brother.
Welcome.